You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, Donald Trump publicly rebukes Theresa May for criticising him for sharing anti-Muslim propaganda. What does this mean for the relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom? My guests Sebastian Borger and Tove O'Brien will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest political developments involving Frau Merkel and her coalition building. And with a new royal commission in Australia, we wonder how useful are public inquiries. We also discuss Reba's House of the Year here in the UK and ask how much these sorts of awards and the discussions they throw up advance the cause of progressive house building. And finally, why do Germans love paying with cash so much? All will be revealed on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Tove O'Brien, News Hub, New Zealand's Europe correspondent. A warm welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Now, President Donald Trump has faced criticism for reposting anti-Muslim propaganda on social media. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May was one of his critics. A spat ensued. Trump replied, "Don't focus on me, focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that's taking place within the United Kingdom." Sebastian, perhaps I'll throw this to you first of all. We've talked about testing times for the special relationship and so on, and Theresa May, for one of the first times, certainly in her premiership, has been quite explicit in criticising something that Trump has, well, said rather than done, I guess. Does this mean that the relationship between the two repivots, changes from here on?
I would have thought she couldn't have done otherwise, really. I mean, it is so very blatant for him to support by retweeting an organisation with a pleasant-sounding name, Britain First, but of course terrible fascist views, really. Mm. Someone reminded us, I think it was a Labour MP called David Lammy here in London, reminded us that the murderer of his colleague Joe Fox last year shouted Britain First before stabbing and shooting her. I don't think the Prime Minister could have done otherwise. The curious fact is that Trump replies. I mean, rather than taking the hint, I'm not sure whether this relationship depends, changes with tweets by a president who is, as we all know, incontinent in his in his utterances. I think if this carried on, then we'd have a problem. But so far, I don't see it. For example, there was talk of a state visit pretty soon.
Well, I mean, does this change the narrative around that? The ambition,
that's been
certainly
pushed. I understand. Even before this latest spat, that's been pushed back way
into the political long grass,
into the blue yonder. Yes.
I think the fact that the government is now saying that no date and no details specifically have been set suggests that it's going to continue to get pushed further and further into that political
long
grass.
Well, and Tover, I guess on that point, it is interesting with Trump. We talk about, it's all well and good just saying he's an exceptional case. We shouldn't get too concerned by what he says, what he doesn't say. But in much the same ways, there's rumours swirling around about changes at the State Department in the US and the way Tillerson's kind of streamlined that. People are now starting to say, well, yes, it doesn't matter if you say he's just a one-off. But is there a potential for enduring damage for the US in terms of how it's perceived internationally, for how it actually engages diplomatically? The business of doing diplomacy can be dealt, if not death blows, serious damage by these sorts of consistent well, utterances, if you can even call them that.
I think so. I really think so. I wish I wasn't still surprised by the things that Donald Trump does and says, but every single day there's something else incendiary, and every single day I'm shocked. And this especially really threw me. And I think there's been a lot of talk today from various MPs and from the Prime Minister herself, Theresa May, saying, you know, the relationship between the UK and US is strongest relationship, yada, yada, yada. It's enduring. It's always, you know, it's bigger than just one president at any given time. And yeah, that's true to an extent. But every day we are just getting chipped away by this guy. And comments like this, I mean, it's not the first time either that he's attacked the UK or made remarks like this. He's capitalised on the Westminster attack. He capitalised on the London Bridge attack. He's attacked several times London's Mayor Sadiq Khan. So I think it would be impossible to say that it's not going to do some kind of enduring damage, because it just defies belief. And I think this, particularly retweeting far-right extremism, incendiary videos that are the origin of which aren't authenticated. I mean, he's promulgating fake news.
Absolutely, which he rails, as he always tells us, he rails against. And it was interesting, wasn't it, Sebastian, as well, that even from within his camp, there was a sort of strange non-apology, non-denial with his press secretary saying, well, frankly, it doesn't even matter if it's true or not, because actually this speaks to a narrative that's playing out. I mean, the sort of brass neck, I know we're getting but talked about that before, yeah. But it still
remember his inauguration, where they told us it was the biggest mass of people in Washington had ever seen, and it simply wasn't true. Two things. Internationally, the soft power of America is being eroded by this man. That there is no doubt about that. I mean, I don't know about you two, but I am certainly someone who's grown up being an Americophile. By the soft power, the Hollywood and Coke and Route 66 and all of that. And sorry, this is getting, every day he does things like that. And every day I see that the parliamentary and democratic system of the US not coping with that. The soft power of the US is diminished. And internally, I would say that's where he's looking. That he's looking at his base. His base. You realize that his ratings are way down. He needs to shore up his base, and that's what he does by telling them that the UK is run over by extremist Muslims and by those kind of fake news stories.
And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, clearly, yeah, Trump continues to speak to that very narrow base in the US, who still, and it's true what you say, especially his popularity.
Not that narrow.
Well, his popularity, it's lower, but amongst his core support, it remains very much at pre-election levels, which is rather extraordinary. Given his focus is so internal, does it frustrate you? I mean, as a sort of foreign correspondent sitting in London, to constantly be tracking, oh, what does this mean for the UK? Frankly, just to have to track him at all, does it kind of get you down? Or is that that's the reality of covering global news and politics, is that he remains centre stage and there's not much any of us can do about it?
I think, I mean, it does frustrate me, and I think it frustrated a lot of US journalists during the election campaign as well, and it frustrated journalists broadly that we were forced in many instances to give him so much airtime.
But who cares about frustrated journalists? I beg your pardon.
I have your profound interests at heart, Sebastian.
Yes, very
course.
Kind.
But what I think is more worrying, though, is the apathy around this guy and the fact that he can say these things on a daily basis.
Is that even more damaging, potentially, in the longer term?
I think so.
People are kind of driven to that.
There's a new phenomenon, like Trump fatigue. People don't want to hear about it anymore. And I almost wonder if that's worse, that people don't want to hear about. And I also wonder if that's why in the last 2 weeks especially, his tweets have just been ramping up. They have gone from like nutty to full-blown bonkers, some of these tweets. That fake news trophy tweet, some of the ones around North Korea especially. You know, we've just gone from nutty to nuttiest.
Look, I mean, the latest North Korean test, his reaction was comparative relatively calm, wasn't it? So,
And that's when you need to wonder about White House intervention. I think what you were saying as well, Tom, about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the fact that she's come out saying, well, you know, it doesn't really matter if these videos themselves that Trump retweeted are real. What matters is that the threat is real. And that's the equivalent of that alternative facts call. But when you've got the White House getting
advocating
in there and advocating
it,
and backing what this guy's saying, the president is saying, it kind of doubles down on the damage, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Trump fatigue, you mentioned that, Tova, and some people, Sebastian, back home in Germany are talking a little about Merkel fatigue. So let's let's look to Germany. It has its own political crisis.
Merkel Dämmerung.
Exactly. The Chancellor's been unable to form a coalition government thus far, certainly with these negotiations with the Free Democrats and the Greens. A grand coalition with the Social Democrats, another option. It presents Merkel and indeed the Social Democrats with a whole different set of challenges. Just bring us up to speed. We've not dipped into this kind of strange scenario, this almost sort of limbo which we're seeing in Germany for a while. Any meaningful progress?
Well, look, the fascinating thing is that, of course, she is now trying to cobble together the old coalition, namely her own conservatives, the slightly more conservative conservatives in Bavaria, the CSU, and the Social Democrats. Now, in those three parties, you have two whose leaders have grave problems. And you'd guess, your guess would be Merkel amongst them? No. Merkel is fine in her own party. You've got the Social Democrats, Martin Schulz, the former president of the European Parliament, who went out on election night and said, never again coalition with the Conservatives, and is now being forced by his own people to at least consider it and to go into talks again, because the Liberals and the Greens... Well, the Liberals really were the ones who gave up on the talks of a coalition, the so-called Jamaica coalition. And severe problems for the Conservatives in Bavaria, who of course lost a lot of votes in the election, and the Premier of Bavaria and party leader has said he would give up some power, but he's not sure when and to what extent. And so there's now a group of elder statesmen and women, average age 74, I think, who support him by finding the correct decision. In fact, on Monday, I think that we'll have a decision by the parliamentary faction in the Bavarian Parliament, and Seehofer, this man, will be presumably out of the job of Premier in Bavaria, maybe hang on to the job of party leader. I'm not sure about that. What I'm saying is, you know, it's very awkward for Merkel because she's got to stroke a lot of egos, and she's got to wait for those parties to actually sort themselves out before she can actually
Does she have the time for that kind of waiting?
Well, look, I think I look at the financial markets, and I look at the figures for consumer figures, and I think the Germans are fine until Christmas.
Okay, so they're
if you don't sort it out by March, I think you have a
problem.
That's
worrying time in the spring. So what do you make of this? Because it's interesting, Martin Schulz, you know, there's plenty of politicians who've said something right before an election, even on election eve, and then backtracked. So presumably he said, we're going into opposition. He could go back into government. That wouldn't be the biggest turnaround of all time. But there's this feeling in Germany, and I think Sebastian sort of alluded to it there, of a bit of a changing of the guard and an uncertainty about where does that septuagenarian generation, who are still many of the big players, go? Are there the political characters knocking around, like back home in New Zealand, who are younger, who can galvanise public, who can end a bit of that ennui that the public have with the whole political process? I mean, does Germany face a changing of the guard moment, do you think, looking from the outside?
Yeah, I think certainly from the outside looking in, New Zealand has proportional representation as well as we got it from you guys, we got it from Germany, so we have MMP too. So we full well know the benefits and pitfalls of a mixed member proportional system. I think what's hard for a lot of people, myself included, to reconcile is, you know, from the outside looking in, that someone as powerful as Angela Merkel was, the most powerful person in Europe, can suddenly just be so heaped under the proverbial. I think if Martin Schulz does flip-flop, he's not going to be the first politician to have done so, and I don't think it will be particularly damaging for him. But in New Zealand, we had an election recently, we looked like we were going into the same humdrum, probably one of the most boring campaigns that we'd had in a long time. You know, two older white men going up against each other, neither that was particularly gripping to the public. And then at the 11th hour in sweeps a 37-year-old woman who galvanised the electorate and took Labour to its first...
Do you think there might be lessons for Germany, looking at how Jacinda Ardern not just jumped in like that and, as you say, sort of rather swept in, but formed a coalition? Because it's part of it about making people feel aspirational and wanting people to be ambitious politically again. Is that, I mean, it's a hard trick to pull off, but could there be a kind of a lesson for the Germans maybe back home?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, Angela Merkel, she's been in power, what, 12 years now, so perhaps there is a degree of fatigue, but New Zealand is, you know, a unique set of circumstances as well, and we don't have all of the same moving parts that Germany has, and we don't have, you know, parties like the Alternative for Germany either. So
your New Zealand First party is pretty right wing, isn't it?
Not so extreme, and they have aligned themselves with both the left and the right in the past. He is, you know, he's more of a populist than a kind of far right party. So we don't have a similar makeup. But yeah, I mean, potentially, I think we should always be looking to other countries for examples of how politics can move and change.
In a word or two, Sebastian, I like asking you this: what happens next? It's an easy question.
It's an easy question, totally easy. I confidently predict, and you can then take me up on it next week or whenever it is. Angela Merkel will still be Chancellor of Germany next year and the year after that. I think she will then have to hand over to whoever it is. I can't see a particular candidate yet, but it's clear that her days are numbered. And had she listened to this program over the last 2 years, she could have heard me advise her to give it up.
Okay, well, there
but
we
did
go.
She?
No.
Give the man a direct line, that's
exactly
what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, Frau Merkel, if you're listening, just patch in and we'll put you on to Sebastian. This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, with Sebastian Borger, Tova O'Brien. Coming up, we'll be asking if public inquiries are worth the cost. And we'll be asking Sebastian, how much money has he got in his wallet?
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're back with Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests, Sebastian Borger and Tova O'Brien. Let's head to Australia next. The country's announced it will hold a Royal Commission inquiry into banks. Many Aussie banks have been involved in various scandals in recent months. A question for both of you, before we ask about this specifically, public inquiries, they're always, I don't know, they seem to sort of frustrate and delight people in equal measure. If you look at what the Australian politicians have been saying, it's either no, the time is wrong, or the time was long ago, why has it taken such a long time? People worry, Tova, about public money and spending it on these, but often it seems this is the only way to really drill down into these controversial areas. What do you make of it?
Yeah, there was a long-running joke in New Zealand about the Green Party forever calling inquiries about anything at any time, over anything, inquiries on inquiries on inquiries on inquiries. But I think that they are important. I think it's accountability. I think that it's important to look at parameters at the and set them up properly, to make sure that the recommendations are streamlined, to monitor that those recommendations are actually being implemented, and to make sure that they don't just go on and on and on and on and on forever and end up costing millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds, which they, you know, have a propensity to do. But then I think if you look at some recent inquiries like the Chilcot inquiry, when it finally did report back, there was no mincing words, you know, and we did get a fairly solid kind of response to what had gone on, and I don't feel like there was I don't feel like he pussyfooted around Blair's role in the Iraq War, and then also the Leveson inquiry. When would we have been able to delve so much into the media in a way that that inquiry did? But I mean, both of those inquiries were kind of loved and hated in equal measure as well.
Well, this is it, I suppose, and they both threw up this question about, yeah, we maybe got some apparent accountability, but did the foundations really change? Certainly in terms of press freedom and accountability, have we seen real progress? Like, the question's unanswered, I suppose, to a degree. What do you make of it, Sebastian? Is there a view, certainly in Germany, that you can't do good, cheap regulation, you can't do self-regulation in a lot of areas, you have to have this sort of scrutiny?
Can I just say, those two examples in Britain, the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq War and the Leveson inquiry into the media, fascinating, yes. Where's the outcome? We don't actually have an outcome. There's no closure on Iraq because, you know, opinions were clearly divided even before, are even more divided now. Leveson, I don't think there's been much change.
So is it a risk that it sort of entrenches positions yet further?
But look, I was going to say something which I followed is the Banking Commission here. There was a parliamentary Banking Commission from both the House of Commons and the Lords in 2012-13, and they reported, and I think 2/3 of their recommendations were then actually implemented by the government. So there are I suppose maybe the Iraq War inquiry was different because it had happened, but. In Germany, certainly, we normally go, it's normally parliaments way to hold the executive to account. So the minor parties in the Bundestag can club together and get a parliamentary inquiry going where the executive has to turn up, otherwise they're in contempt of parliament. And that has often, again, I think, brought stuff to the surface which needed to be aired and has sometimes also led to clear outcomes.
And I suppose just in terms of the private sector, or specifically within the banking sector, and some of these players are obviously present in New Zealand as well, I guess, Toby, is it long overdue? I mean, critics of Turnbull accused him of dragging his feet, and there's been a sense, prevailing sense, for certainly, a decade or so, maybe longer, that this was a whole industry that needed to be, if not rocked to its foundation, certainly shaken up a good deal.
Yeah, I don't think Malcolm Turnbull was just dragging his feet, but he had lead shoes on while dragging his feet. This is long overdue, and I don't think he's done it suddenly out of the goodness of his heart and for the desire to seek transparency in the banking system. I think he was backed into a corner. He had to do so. Next week he was facing a private member's bill, which his government was likely going to lose, and it was going to force an inquiry anyway, so it was better to get ahead of that and look like he was being proactive, and so too the banks. Four of the major banks signed a collective letter as well, saying, yes, even though we've fought this tooth and nail for yonky donks, now we are willing to push on with this inquiry.
We talked about sort of surprising U-turns. That was quite surprising that they managed to obviously all get together and decide that maybe the time was now.
Indeed.
Which is unusual, I guess.
It was, but a lot of the speculation around that is that if they get ahead of it, they can kind of torpedo the terms of references, and maybe it will be a narrower inquiry than perhaps would have been forced next week if that private members' bill had gone ahead.
Quite possibly very accurate.
The interesting thing, of course, about the Australian banks is that they were totally more or less untouched by the financial crisis that we all went through here in Europe. And we've had our inquiries, even with a few years delay in the UK's case and Germany's case. But these are recent scandals where you think, well, guys, Do you not actually look around the world and see what happens to your peers in other countries? Do you not then implement the rules that government has set you? I mean, the largest lender, Commonwealth Bank, they had to notify the government of any payment, any cash payment of more than $10,000, I think. They simply didn't do it. That's breaking the law. You know, there's no two ways about it. So the CEO had to go. But I think unless you then put people in jail, things won't change. Commission, royal or not.
Okay, let's move on and back to the UK. A new country home in Kent was named House of the Air by the prestigious REBA, Royal Institute of British Architects, just around the corner from us. It's a huge house set in beautiful countryside, the Garden of England, of course. But is it the best solution or any sort of solution when society's complaining about chronic lack of new housing, lack of space in cities, a general lack of funds, expertise directed into social housing? Toby, does this matter? It's interesting, REBA sort of defended this and said, oh, well, no, there may be learnings for social housing in cities, which I thought was a rather weak line. Would they have been better served to say, look, this is an amazing architectural undertaking, it's been delivered incredibly well, and we can celebrate that simply for what it is? Is that one of the issues here?
This place has its very own concert hall. It has a multi-storied courtyard. It's over 1,400 square metres. I think that's the equivalent I read somewhere of 13 three-bedroom family homes. So to say that this house is somehow a solution to the housing crisis defies belief.
Unless everyone's going to move in, it probably isn't.
Everybody. Literally everybody.
Sounds a bit like your house, Sebastian.
If only.
But on a serious note, though, how do we balance this challenge between getting better at building social housing, affordable housing,
we're not valuing
that's well designed, and bringing in the innovators who are often within the architectural firm and working at the sort of cutting edge on private commissions like this? How do we balance those sort of sometimes conflicting demands?
We don't give prices for good social housing. We don't give rarely, I should say. Mm. We rarely give prices to a well-designed kindergarten. We give prices to, one-off penis buildings like the Shard here in London or similar skyscrapers. I think that's the bottom line. We're not valuing it. Typically, when I look at that building online, I haven't seen it in sort of as is. Typically, I don't see bedrooms. I don't see living rooms. But that's the crux of the matter. How do people actually live in there? How do they feel living in there or working in there? I think architects make the mistake and the public swallows it hook, line and sinker. It's got to look great. Yes. Of course, it has to. We have an aesthetic feeling about architecture. But in the end, what matters is, how do you live, how do you work in those buildings? Mm. And often the ones that look great are terrible to work in. I speak from experience. By all means, an innovative design, great. But focus, if you give the Sterling Prize for Architecture for the next 15 years to people who have designed good social housing, a nice school, a good hospital, that's when things will change.
A call to action. Inspirational stuff from you, Sebastian. And I must ask you on a tangential theme, perhaps. Here's a question. Why do Germans love playing with cash? My colleague has alerted me that of all EU countries, Germans carry the most cash in their wallets, an average north of 100 euros each, 103 to be specific.
On average.
At the risk of alerting the moped muggers of Marylebone.
Yes, don't.
Do you follow this?
£73.
Do you follow? So, I mean, still a robust sum. Why are the Germans?
£73.
Why are the Germans in love with cash still, Sebastian?
Because we don't like to get into debt. So when we go out and spend money, we like to know there's some money in our pocket, and we hand it over for a new coat or whatever it is, and and then we know we don't have any money.
Always balancing the books. Tova, what about you? It's back home, and I guess I don't know if you've imported this to London as well. I imagine New Zealand being fairly progressive, one of these sort of engage with plastic societies. Is it like our Nordic brethren where it'll be cashless within a few months?
Thank you, Tom. Yes, we are very progressive. Thank you. We were one of the first countries to adopt FPOS. So we had FPOS machines before most countries brought it on board. So yes, we do like using our cards. I think 60% of retail sales are by card. I use a bit of cash here because I kind of have to.
How much? But
I have a fiver in my wallet, only
she's
because you made me check.
There we go.
And
so
a few Israeli shekels, a couple of euros and a few pennies.
We'll leave it there. Sebastian, will you win? You win the money. You win the money game 70-5. Thanks to Sebastian. Thanks to Tova O'Brien. My name's Tom Edwards. Thanks to all the team behind today's programme. Do join us at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.